hours of Showtime. The first hour is going to be with Patrick Doherty. And Patrick Doherty is an expert in homeowner associations and the consequences that result from that. Second hour is going to be regular guest William Roberts, who's going to talk about regionalism and how it's invaded the United States. But Patrick Doherty, our guest this hour, is currently serving a second term as board president of a homeowner association in Las Vegas, Nevada. He is active nationally in helping other homeowner associations fight abuse from their boards and from the management companies and associations' attorneys, which often happens in these homeowner association dynamics. I'm told by Patrick that after hearing Tom DeWeese on a show on the Commons, that's with a prior guest of ours, Sue Bartholomew, she has a radio program that deals regularly with homeowner associations, and after visiting our website, it became clear to him that there was a direct connection between the attack on property rights via sustainable development, smart growth, on the macro level, and the erosion of homeowner rights via homeowner associations on the micro level. Well, Patrick, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're glad you're here because, you know, we talk regularly about sustainable development, looking at it from the international and both internationally and domestically, and how it really is eroding the entire framework and spirit of the great American experiment. And it's important sometimes to get it right down to the brass tacks, how it is that this transformation of American values is occurring right before our eyes. And for those who have lived in homeowner associations often well know there's something about homeowner associations that leads to the erosion of individual rights and property rights. And you do a good job of explaining how that occurs. So let me ask you to begin to explain to our audience just what that's all about.
Yes. Well, Michael, first of all, homeowner associations are complex. There's a lot of moving parts. They're often, when there's conflict or strife within the community, it often becomes very emotional and a sense of outrage, as everybody has such a vested interest in the outcome of whatever's facing the association at that time. But just by way of background, for analysis purposes, it's been my observation that this is homeowner associations have ballooned in the last, particularly during the recent real estate bubble. And further research has led me to view them as basically a top-down central planning scheme that mandates deed-restricted, one-size-fits-all housing.
Well, I certainly have recognized that here in Santa Cruz, if a developer goes in and has a project, multiple housing units that he wants to build, he is required to implement a homeowner association, and the rules that he's required to live by are dictated by the government. So,
well, specifically dictated typically by the planning commissions. And the same people that are duped into these smart growth sustainable development schemes. And, you know, as you analyze it, the end product is basically a beige world of Moscow tract homes and government schools. And the marketing, they're marketed and promoted under the bald promise of protecting property values. Homeowner associations, are, in my view, are transforming the country into a nation of sharecroppers, subject to plantation politics or banana republics writ large. Socially, which is where I've seen a lot of the strum and drain, the stress and storm, is that HOAs are crazy makers.
Well, we'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show in just a moment. We're back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. While some stations take a commercial break, we'll continue our discussion with Patrick Doherty. Well, it certainly is the case that homeowner associations contend that they protect property values. But I've often said on this show, in the context of smart growth generally, that to protect property values, at the expense of property rights results in a loss of both.
That's correct. That's correct. In fact, I think it's rather arrogant of industry to presume that through their electioneering techniques and micromanaging the affairs and lives of homeowners that they are going to have an impact on property values, when the facts are that it's typically the integrity of the architecture, the location, and other linkages to employment, shopping, and scenic and recreational opportunities that are the determinants of value. And when pressed for proof of this notion of maintaining and preserving property values, industry is unable to produce any hard evidence of that. Instead, the debate is typically dumbed down to a notion of good HOA, bad HOA, purple houses, cars up on blocks, and all manner of rather minutiae and trivial notions of what really goes on in these communities. But initially, going back to the social aspects of these homeowner associations, in the short term, they preserve the developer's vision for the project in order for him to finish marketing them. But this is at the expense of the long-term quality of life of the consumer after they move into the compound, from the simple fact that the CC&Rs are often conflicting and confusing and are, again, top-down. They're to protect the developer's interests and aren't really designed to facilitate efficient and effective oversight or governance of the association. And no one, and frankly, home buyers are duped into this. They didn't realize that they needed to get into politics or run for the board or hire a lawyer to protect or enforce their rights. Frankly, homeowners are flimflam. And they discover too late that they've traded away a legal political system founded on majority rule with minority rights for more of a rule-by-neighbor culture with no rights, only rules, restrictions, and regulations.
I remember, Patrick, we're going to welcome our audience back here shortly, but I remember back in the old 80s, homeowner associations were thought pretty lowly, and there was sort of an adverse reaction to the whole idea. We'll be right back here. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. Our special guest, Patrick Doherty, has been explaining how homeowner associations preserve a short-term developer's vision for a project, but they do this at the expense of long-term quality of life of the consumer who has moved in to the compound. And could you give us some examples of how that plays out, how the bright, shiny vision of these homeowner associations turn into nightmares for particular homeowners?
Well, in what context? Typically, recently, what you're finding is it depends. I guess recently, with the hyper real estate market, a lot of these projects were sold to a high percentage of small bore investor buyers, and homeowners were moving into a community that they thought was primarily owner-occupants. Later discover that in some cases 50-65% of the units were sold to non-owner-occupants. And that becomes particularly problematic given the apathy to obtain interest in anybody even running for the board or getting involved in any capacity. And then it becomes somewhat fair game for the construction defect attorneys to move in and in some cases kind of drum up, gin up some construction defect lawsuit against the developer that's subsequently passed on to the insurance carrier that maybe not is in the best interest of the association as a whole.
Okay.
But at any rate, no one really realized, like we were talking about, Michael, no one really realized when they were purchasing a home in an HOA that they needed to get into politics or run for the board, hire an attorney to protect their home and enforce their rights. And they often discover too late that they've traded away a legal political system founded on majority rule with minority rights for kind of a rule-by-neighbor culture with no rights, only rules, restrictions, and regulations. And the same goes, it holds true for the communities that were duped into adopting a smart growth agenda and related new urbanism or planned community schemes that produce monopoly conditions that effectively foreclose alternate non-HOA housing options or consumer choice in the marketplace. Fast-growing Gilbert, Arizona, among others, has declared all new construction must be with an HOA. If not, no building permits will be issued.
Wow. Now, does the city have a role in determining what the HOA provisions would be?
Well, no, just from my understanding, it's just that they have one. And those are typically boilerplate because you'll have typically one or two law firms within a community that specialize in that, those drafting of those documents. They're fairly boilerplate with various differences between states, California, Arizona, Nevada, Florida, for example.
Patrick, this is Roy Avila. Where did the notion of homeowners associations come from, and how long have they been around?
Well, homeowner associations, from the research that I've done, talking about homeowner associations, effectively you're talking about CCNRs. And I think that like a lot of these urban schemes, they were had their beginnings in racism. If you look back historically, a lot of communities, Kansas City's Garden Club District comes to mind, had a lot of deed restrictions that barred any blacks from occupying the house or moving into the community unless they were acting as in capacity as a servant. As 2 weeks ago, states have passed legislation overturning those and banning those restrictions. They haven't been enforced for a number of years, but the HOA phenomena grew out of that, had its roots in that, and initially those were typically targeted for upper income buyers. Where this is where you get the gated community concept, it's kind of to keep out washed. But it's only been within the last, say, 10 years that you've really seen this HOA scheme generalized on the mainstreamed in the housing market to all income ranges.
Well, it certainly is almost necessarily a part of so-called affordable housing or government-subsidized housing. I know here in Santa Cruz, there are homeowner associations that actually prohibit the occupants from owning a car. It's located by the Rail Transit Authority, and people are expected to either ride the train or ride buses. And cars are prohibited. So, I think there's some individual circumstances that crop up in the context of so-called affordable, meaning subsidized housing, that are sort of moving the ball backwards when it comes to recognizing private property and individual liberty.
Well, exactly, and this notion, once again, you've got the government interjecting itself into the marketplace, they kind of turned the American dream inside out. It's upside down. It's based on restrictions and not rights. And it's my view, this is designed to accelerate the race towards this public-private government canard.
Well, that's a regular topic on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Public-private partnership is the antithesis of private property, and it is coming into every community across the country through federal legislation, state legislation, and what local legislators who've been well-trained in the smart growth provisions are bringing about. If you're not part of the public-private partnership, you're just out of the system as it's beginning to develop. And public-private partnership is a totally un-American concept for economics. We're built on the idea of private property in a public-private partnership dynamic. Of course, private property isn't possible. You might have permission to do this or that, but it is not a right that comes by virtue of being a human being. You do not get to own what you own or do what you do because of an inherent right. Your rights under public-private partnership are because you've been granted a right. You individually have been granted a right by the governing power to do what it is that you've been given the right to do.
Well, exactly. And this relates to homeowner associations. Imagine promoting a corporate board versus a democratic governance model to operate a community. Legally, HOAs are sui generis, a hybrid. And as law professor and author Evan McKenzie identified in his classic Privatopia, they're often one election away from disaster. And, you know, what we're seeing here is we're creating a community association society of modern-day company towns. And they're characterized, I've seen it firsthand, they're characterized by apathy, conflict, and fear.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Let's see what our caller has to say. It's Tony from La Selva Beach. Welcome, Tony. You have a question or a comment?
Hey, guys, I have a question. Has anybody or any developers got together and actually challenged the law in court requiring homeowner associations in order for them to develop?
Do you know of any, Patrick?
Well, I could address that, and that's that what you have. You have to distinguish between your merchant builders, the Del Webbs, the Pulteys, and your small municipal builders. And the large merchant builders and the investment bankers are aligned with the Urban Land Institute. The Urban Land Institute is the brain trust that typically has a great deal of influence over the nation's graduate schools in their real estate programs and their urban planning programs. And it's going to be very hard for a smaller developer to bring an action in court just because they're in a fight for their life to acquire land and be able to compete and bid against the large merchant builders who have access to the public bond markets and are able to inventory large amounts of land in anticipation of building or even hyping up a real estate market in a particular area. In other words, when the air was kind of coming out of Las Vegas, they rolled into Phoenix, Arizona, and then headed to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And you see the same beige product there and things like that.
Well, it does tend to make developments quite uniform. It's interesting that those who will attack the aesthetics of typical tract developments in California are the same people who aspire and subscribe to the concept of homeowner associations, which really does make one house the same as the next house, and everybody's got to toe the line or they get in trouble. Tony, my look at Santa Cruz would be that if a landowner went in with the intention to subdivide his property, he'd get nowhere if he didn't adopt some standard kinds of CC&Rs and maybe not so standard types of CC&Rs that this planning department would require.
For our audience, what's a CC&R?
Code, condition, and restriction. Covenants, restrictions.
Covenant.
Yeah, covenants, CC, covenants, conditions, and restrictions. I'm sorry. But those are all the guiding rules that require how a subsequent homeowner has to live. And the caller's question is a good one, because the idea of just buying a lot with a house on it and being reasonable, not breaking laws, and living your own life is what the American dream was all about. Well, we're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show in just a moment.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. We're talking about homeowners associations. And before we got started, I did want to mention how much fun it was last week to have such interaction with our listeners. So we do want to remind you that the phone number is 888-245-4237. And if you have a comment or a question, give us a call. We'd be happy to hear from you.
Fair enough. And back to the subject, Patrick, tell us more,
please. Well, I would say this, and that's that I'm optimistic because I'm seeing signs that the invisible hand is beginning to surface. As no HOA, no CCR homes are beginning to command a premium, as the more sophisticated and informed consumers are beginning to reject their government-mandated sickle in favor of a more normalized, less conformist community or neighborhood. And you're seeing this in the advertising. They will, if they're hard to find, but if they are able to get a listing, the realtors are promoting the no HOA concept. And in some cases, they're commanding a premium of up to 25-30% over and above a comparable home in an HOA community.
You know, and that's great news, but the other, I don't know, sinister is probably a better word, but I know in Silicon Valley, in San Jose, the existing older homes and neighborhoods are being promoted by strong neighborhood initiatives, a lot of smart growth styled programs, and what they're encouraging people to do, and they start it usually with a neighborhood watch program. Oh, be safe, get a neighborhood watch program. And you know what else? You need to form a neighborhood association so when you have an issue and you want to come to the city to talk about what's happening in your neighborhood, we don't want you to come as individuals. We want you to come as an authorized neighborhood association. So neighborhood associations are still being promoted in previous existing neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. They're trying to co-opt HOA-free zones and bring them under the HOA deed-restricted umbrella. However, I would say this, that some homeowners are becoming aware of that and are fighting it.
Good. Just say no, as we say at Freedom 21.
Aware.
Well, I think that's the right advice, Roy, because you know, I've been an owner up at Lake Tahoe in a homeowner association, and it did nothing for about 5 years. And now there's a fellow who's really got his fighting power up, and he wants to make life difficult for a number of residents. We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio.
Well, Michael, you seem to have your own experience with homeowners association. Please enlighten us, because it's very typical of, and I'm sure Patrick will concur with us that, you know, some people get in here and then they get a little power drunk and all of a sudden things go crazy.
Well, you know, that's the experience that I've seen, and of course I'm here in Santa Cruz regularly and up at Lake Tahoe very infrequently, but a new manager of the Homeowner Association came in up in Incline Village, Nevada, and boy, they have been shaking the trees and creating havoc all over the place. They demand to get in your house and to do this and that. If you
don't get your garbage can out away in time, you're going to be in trouble.
Or if a friend comes over and happens to park in the street, holy smokes, they might as well be calling the police on you. It's just it's just a big mess. And I do remember back in the 1980s, living in San Jose at the time, that homeowner associations were popularly disliked, and the condominium projects back at that time in San Jose were losing value like crazy. Now that's turned around, and like you say, the Sweet Neighbors Initiative, whatever it is.
Strong Neighborhood Initiatives.
Strong Neighborhood Initiatives, the smart growth planning that has been set in San Jose for decades now is coming into full fruition. And, you know, by the looks of what I see, if you don't have a homeowner association in San Jose, they're going to work hard to give you one.
Well, I have a nephew who's a recent purchased a home, him and his young wife and family, and I try to warn him. I said, be careful about that. But he has just, I mean, he planted a tree, and it was the wrong tree, and, you know, I mean, just all kinds, you know, his mailbox had a little extra mail in it. I mean, all kinds of what people would think would be ridiculous things going on. He's been fined. You know, he's been sent several nasty letters about, well, you know, if you don't fix this, we'll fix it for you, kind of thing.
Right, with a big cost to you. Well, I'm glad to hear from you, though, Patrick, that in a number of markets, the whole idea of homeowner associations is being rejected by the market, and a premium is being attached to housing units that don't come with HOAs, because as it's become apparent to you, it's apparent to myself and to Roy, I'm sure, that HOAs are they were a precursor and really become a reflection of the smart growth movement. And smart growth is about destroying private property and having everyone conform to the rules of a new order, not just a new world order, a new American order. And it seems to be coming along pretty quickly. But I'm heartened to hear that there are regions around the country that are rejecting the whole idea of HOAs.
Yes, yes. And I think it will come full circle where HOAs will become stigmatized housing product. You have to analyze it. You know, what thinking person is going to want to live in those kind of conditions for long? In fact, there are stories of children that have reached home buying age that dismiss homeowner associations after observing what their parents have gone through. And, you know, you mentioned the consternation that's developing in your homeowner association. I've seen that before. That's not by accident. That's a mission. They're on a fine lien foreclosure mission. And you had a relative.
That's fine, fine, F-I-N-E, lien and foreclose.
Foreclosure. Hmm. What they're doing is that typically management companies can't really make, they can make a good living on the management, but they can get wealthy on the derivative income that they're able to achieve by petty fines, frivolous fines, creating conflict within the community. The next thing they'll be advising that if you don't like this fellow, and they typically seek out the weakest links and put them up in charge, useful idiots. Then they'll say, well, if you don't like it, start have a recall. Get involved. You need to get involved in your community. Well, that'll further polarize the community and set you up for smear campaigns, defamation articles in the newsletter, and other fair gaming activities. And when you go up against them, you'll find out that not only is there no oversight or state agency that you can go to, but you're outmoneyed and you're outgunned. And worse, you're fighting your own money because they're able to use the association's monies to fight you, and or you've got a moral hazard. And that these board members are able to act with impunity and operate outside the law, often with the aided and abetted by the slip and fall trade lawyers that they've retained for advice, guidance, and counsel, and roll it off on the association's directors and officers insurance.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back on Freedom 21. Welcome back. We're at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program, and if you have a homeowner's experience that you would like to share, because right now it's just Patrick, Michael, and myself, talking about some of the experiences that we've been, but we'd like to hear from people, and it's 888-245-4237, and you can join in on our conversation. You know, Patrick, continue with that. It was, what, fine, lean, and foreclose. I think we kind of got to the fine part, but let's talk about lean and foreclose.
Well, typically the pattern is that there will be a change in management, and this will be maybe a more aggressive firm. They're typically, it's my observation that the industry, the Community Associations Institute, now all management firms that are members of CAI are not criminals, but it's my observation that you have a criminal element operating within the association, using it as cover, particularly in Florida, Arizona, Nevada, and California. Now, I can't speak to other states, but I can speak to those states that I've mentioned. And the game is this. They come in a previously peaceful community that was basically a maintenance or landscaping garden club association is turned upside down. They begin aggressively fining for trivial and frivolous items, garbage cans out, garage doors open, and immediately they are able to create some contention within the community. And at that point, not only do the fines come in, but then people ignore that. They ignore the fine notices. They don't realize that what they've gotten into, that they can actually be foreclosed on and lose their home. And here's where the abuse comes in. Typically, a $300 fine can escalate into $3,000 to $5,000 in fees to cure after the file is turned over to the association's attorney, the Institute Foreclosure Proceedings. And you can go into the public records in any of these communities, and you'll find there's typically two or three law firms that specialize in this. And not only are they able to have questionable sweetheart deals or their non-arm's length transactions in conveying these foreclosures, because you see these horror stories pop up all the time where somebody's lost all their free and clear home over a $3,000, $5,000 lien that they had. And some of these people have health problems. They're not aware. They don't have anybody assisting them. But at any rate, this is what happens. I can tell you exactly what's going to happen in your association. They'll get everything to the boiling point, and where there'll be people will be pounding the table at the board meetings, and the management, you'll call in to speak to management, they'll tell you to start a recall, run for the board, get involved. And that'll further polarize the community, because you'll have the sock puppets that victims of the Stockholm syndrome. They want to please their eager to please the powers that be, and then you become a target yourself. You and your group will be targeted for smear campaigns, either via the newsletter or further aggressive actions in terms of fines and things like that. And so while all these things sound good on paper, they just don't work in real life, because they're inherently flawed. And that there's a moral hazard with the board. They can operate outside the law, aided and abetted by their slip and fall trade lawyer. And if they get caught, if there's a problem, if you happen to have deep enough pockets to sue, they'll turn it over to their D&O carrier, the directors and officers insurance. So not only are you fighting your own, fighting the association with your own money, because they're using monies out of your assessments and monthly assessments, but you're going up against formidable resources, particularly when the D&O carrier gets involved.
Have you heard of anybody who's fought and won?
Very rarely, because now they've instituted this notion of you've got mandatory ADR, alternative dispute resolution. And in Nevada, for example, you cannot file in district court until you've been certified that you've completed the ADR process. The ADR process is nothing more than trying to give the little man the sense that he's had his day in court. It's a practical matter. It just doubles the expenses and delays that any sense of justice. And you're not going to really get that. I haven't seen anybody get justice by any means. If they do, when it's all over, they're broken as individuals. They're emotionally shattered because of the stress of the trial. And I've known personally, I've attended trials where the homeowner has battled and has spent in excess of $500,000.
Wow.
In these cases, it's not untypical. It's not uncommon to have homeowners fight these things in hundreds of thousands of dollars, not tens of thousands of dollars. Typically, it's tens of thousands in the ADR venue. And by that time, they've thrown in the towel. And I advise any homeowners, don't sue your HOA. For God's sakes, move.
Well, that's a difficult thing for older people particularly. They've lived a whole life without this kind of, I'll call it sustainable development model or smart growth model being placed on their head. That's got to be devastating particularly for some older people.
Well, I analyzed this, and that's that these older people are on typically fixed incomes, fixed or limited incomes, and then after they've gone through and got a lot of commotion going within the community with the fines and the liens, then they're going to go for the reserve account. And what that means is that at some point they're going to have to assess the members rather jaw-dropping dollar amount. In any amount is excessive, is unbearable to most seniors. Particularly, you analyze this. A lot of these projects now are maturing. They're underfunded because in requiring some capital improvements. And as you can see, look at the dysfunction that took place down in Florida with the hurricanes. People, it's been over a year, and these seniors still aren't back in their condominiums. Some are even had an article a week ago about a fellow that's been living in his car, senior citizen. Why? Well, you've got these Bigfoot boards. Everybody knows, every contractor, every attorney, and every management company will tell you off the record, you know, these individuals as a group couldn't run a one-pump gas station, yet they're at the helm of, you know, several million dollars, and throw a hurricane in there that requires some real expertise. It's just not going to happen, and that's why you have the seniors. My heart goes out to them because I see them time and time again. This notion of sustainable development and smart growth, they don't really understand that, but they do know when they're hit with a $6,000 or $16,000 special assessment. And if they can't pay it, there you go. A lien is filed on their property, and it's off to the races.
Patrick, I'm going to have to steal that one pump gas station line. That was a beautiful line.
But in the meantime, Ronnie from Arizona is on the line. Ronnie, good evening, and what's your comment or question?
Are you speaking to me?
Yes, I am. Are you Ronnie?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ronnie.
Well, I just wanted to enlighten you a little bit about some of the Arizona laws and the unconstitutional behavior of our state legislature with regards to HOAs.
Go right ahead.
Well, okay.
Could you turn your radio down, please?
I was just going to say, it's actually not my radio, it's my internet.
Oh, all right, I went on the internet, f21sc.net.
Exactly, yes, it's wonderful, thank you. And thank you for covering these issues. In Arizona, all homeowners used to enjoy what they called homestead exemption protection. It basically meant that nobody can foreclose on your home for debt except by consensual lien. You know, like when you sign papers with the mortgage company, literally securing your home for the loan. In 1996, the state legislature exempted homeowners living in HOAs from that homestead exemption with regard to the HOAs.
Wow.
Then they also gave them what they call non-judicial lien power. They don't even have to prove you owe the money. They make constant bookkeeping errors. People show up with their canceled checks saying, look, I paid you. They say, too bad. No, you didn't. They file liens against them, then they start foreclosure proceedings.
And have you heard any stories along those lines that have gone well?
Well, just that's gone well?
Yes, where righteousness was achieved and the homeowner association had a big price to pay.
No. However, we did have one lady recently where the attorney was trying to collect over $6,000 in fees for collecting $300 in past due assessments,
wow,
which she paid by cashier's check, and the lawyer returned to her. She paid $1,400 to cover the $300 debt. Then the lawyer returned the check to her because he wanted $6,000 in fees. The judge even told him he didn't see how this was a prudent action to continue pursuing her for it. They're still in litigation.
Wow.
After the lawyer promised he would work something out in the hallway.
Well,
and I witnessed that myself.
It's that kind of legislative harassment that too many states have been subjected to. And I know, you know, Roy, in working in San Jose, where you work, you know, I had an interaction with a city council lady, a young woman, pleasant enough, but she'd had her smart growth training, and she was fully on board for all the local legislation that would deal with issues like this from a smart growth perspective, and she thought this was a virtuous thing to do. And I think most of our elected officials have just lost contact with what the American ideal is, and the rules and the laws and the kinds of results that Ronnie's talking about are just happening all too often.
Well, I think they get on the gravy train. You know, they when they go to these trainings, you know, they're you know, they get flown out. You know, they get great treatment. You know, they're right on the gravy train. They don't get to talk to their constituents, but they talk to each other. So, you know, it's like me telling you, oh yes, this is a great thing, and you just go okay, and they just fall right in line.
Well, it sounds like in this area, Patrick was right, as Ronnie demonstrates. Arizona's one of the leaders, in this abuse.
Yes, you know, it just to expand on the legislative aspect of things, you have to realize that homeowners are not organized, whereas the industry is, and they have deep pockets, and they are able to hire paid lobbyists that can buttonhole these legislators and to establish a relationship with them, whether it be, you know, special trips or fine dining or just, you know, picnic lunch on the lawn of the Capitol. During recess of the hearings, and that takes place, and so they're able to do this. And again, a lot of these things, they sound very good on paper, but you know, the reality is that they don't work. It's about as effective as FEMA trying to get a drink of water from FEMA.
Well, you hear that all the time in the smart growth initiatives. Whatever they present always sounds real good. The language is manipulated, so it's not what it sounds like it's supposed to be. It's just all to lead you down the garden path.
Well, I'm not so sure it sounds all that good, Roy. I mean, you know, I think if a person is a bit circumspect and draws upon some sense of American history and a realization that individual liberty is what's guided this country for some 200 years, that's quickly slipping away. And when you're promised something for nothing at someone else's expense, you need to think twice. And all these smart growth proposals promise that, well, you're going to have a view shed. We're going to steal these folks' property so that you've got a view shed, or we're going to come in through homeowner associations and impose these rules about how you live in order to hold up your property value. Well, gee whiz, I may be simple in my way of thinking, but that always means when you're getting something for nothing, somebody else is paying, and that makes you a party to a theft.
Well, Michael, you know, the interesting thing is that as you analyze whether it's the smart growth proposals or the homeowner associations, it's based on restrictions and not on rights. And this is where it becomes fairly easy to analyze these things. If you analyze it from that standpoint of rights, will always be at odds with the industry, always be at odds with the smart growth proponents or the Community Associations Institute, because they're motivated by restrictions, whereas just intuitively and by spirit, humans are motivated by freedom and rights. And this is why these things sound good, but it's a canard, it's a Trojan horse. And again, these are complex. There's a lot of moving parts to these things, and it's awfully difficult to make it real simple so that the legislature can understand it. Particularly when you've got paid lobbyists whispering in their ear, And for a homeowner to get up there and often fear of public speaking, or they don't quite have the poise, or the, more importantly, they don't have the money. But I see that changing. I see the Internet as being a major tool for activists. At least politically, it's been demonstrated, whether you are Democrat or Republican, that the Dean campaign was able to effectively, they knew what they were doing, they were able to use the Internet to raise $14 million, something like that, maybe it was $7 million, while the others were only able to raise a million or two. And granted, Dean lost, but he did end up as head of the Democratic Party. And you could look to the governor's race in Minnesota, where he was effectively able to use the Internet and ran and was elected as a third-party candidate. So I see some optimism here, because I think that people are becoming more aware of the problems with these things. My concern is with these condominiums and things like that, that they should come with a Surgeon General's warning label or an investor suitability criteria before people get into this, because people are getting into these things and they're kind of sold a bill of goods. And the thing about the Agenda 21 and the Freedom 21, it opened my eyes up to the role of the government schools play in all this, and kind of dumbing down the citizens, and kind of getting this notion of seeking comfort in conformity. And you know, the real solutions are found with risk-taking and entrepreneurialism. And I understand that, you know, we have some real problems and constraints with congestion and things like that, but this idea of living next to the mall, I don't think is a practical solution to it at this time.
Well, and of course, that is the thrust that that all of California is taking, backed by both Democrat and Republican administrations. Land is just being lopped off from living. People are being squeezed further and further into small areas. I know one of the smart growth leaders here in Santa Cruz has called for 14 and 15 story buildings along the coast, all to be smart growth driven and HOA run. And anything outside that urban core is just simply off limits. And the only way that changes is if the land ends up in the hands of one of their public-private partners. I know that Santa Cruz is a bit further advanced than most communities, but all across the nation, communities are following the example of places like Santa Cruz, and of course that's why we do this radio show from here and call it Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. You know, it's a national issue, but here in Santa Cruz we're able to point to real dynamics that bring it right home, and can show you what you can look forward to if you're not already into this muck called sustainable development. Well,
I have one thing to add.
Please, Ronnie, go ahead.
Governments have all the incentive in the world to continue, local governments, to continue to promote and encourage the HOA developments, because essentially the initial agreement is that the developer will pay for the infrastructure, and then the local government gets to continue taxing those homeowners, but are abrogated from their responsibilities to those citizens. They don't pick up their trash, they won't send animal control, they don't have to do anything. Half the time they don't have to maintain the streets or the, you know, flood protection berms or anything like that. And so the homeowners pick up that tab, and then they pay twice when they pay their property taxes. And their property taxes are inflated because the price of the home was inflated because it was the infrastructure was built into the cost of the home. And so it causes this bizarre inflation that has nothing to do with real numbers, and the homeowner is literally being double taxed at an extremely high rate based on these inflated numbers.
Ronnie, you're very good. How'd you get involved in this?
I had a condo, and I was miserable, and now I live in the HOA free zone, and
yes,
I have joy. Mm-hmm. But I continue to fight it because it's just, like he said, they are actively encouraging my neighborhood. Oh, you should come together. You should form a neighborhood association. And I actively give my neighbors paperwork constantly. Don't go to those meetings. Don't participate. Don't go to the parties. And so we don't anymore, and they haven't had one in a really long time.
Don't go to the parties. Talk about that real quick.
Well, the cities sponsor, and some police officers and fire trucks, and pay for the little jumpy balloon thing, you know, and they set it up at the local park. They invite all the neighbors. They supply food. And they tell us, you see, you could have this type of community and party every month if you would just form an association.
Wow.
You know, I'd say this to you, Ronnie. If you happen to desire to write something explaining this experience, send it to us, because it's the kind of story we like to publish at Freedom 21, so that others begin to see the dynamic that shapes into these homeowner associations.
Yeah, and send us an email, if I could spit that out, because we'd like to stay connected with you.
I would love to, and I signed up for your newsletter, and I have your web address bookmarked, and so I will.
Great. We really appreciate your call. Thanks so much.
And thank you for the time.
And if other listeners out there are not receiving the report, which comes out periodically from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, go to our website, f21sc.net, and right there you can sign up to receive our periodic report that will give you this kind of information and more on a regular basis so that you can begin in your own neighborhood seeing how we're being reshaped and how our individuality is being stripped away under massive amounts of rules that are falling on us every day from every direction. And if you're a Californian, that's particularly true. And of course, we have a heavy focus on what the governor, the legislature, and local boards of supervisors are doing here in the state of California.
Because you don't have to look far. It's right there.
It's right there. But as people begin to acknowledge what's really happening in America here in the early 21st century, you know, it is not too late to shift this trend and shake this monkey off our backs and begin to respect each other and live a free existence once again. Well, Patrick, what are your observations generally on HOAs? I know you've said that you see in some states support for them falling away. Can you give us any more information on
and
that?
Has there been any example of actually someone terminating a homeowners association somewhere?
Well, this is I find most interesting, because there's a number of these associations. I'm talking about single families where there's no rational reason for them to exist, except maybe a 15-foot plot of tulips. And I think that you're going to find a cottage industry. Now, I understand down in Florida this has started, a cottage industry of attorneys, accountants, and real estate entrepreneurs that are going in and unwinding these associations, sunsetting them, because of the increase in value that can be captured, the windfall profits that can be captured by on doing these cumbersome associations. Homeowner associations are a failed experiment. They're designed to fail. And I think that you can just see, because of the apathy, that they are rejected in the marketplace. When a buyer goes shopping, he doesn't have homeowners association on the top of his list. Further, my observations are, I don't think it's all doom and gloom. I see the internet becoming a valuable tool. I see advocacy groups from Chore out of Arizona or Cyber Citizens out of Florida in various radio programs such as yours or on the Commons, getting the word out. And also what I find real interesting is this eminent domain initiatives that are taking place. These are petition drives to get the Kelos decision overturned, and in a number of states, Idaho, Oregon, and others, they're taking it one step further. They are attempting to have this eminent domain extend to if your land use has been changed or you are being targeted for these smart growth territories, planned unit, planned communities, that the property owner needs to be compensated for the taking, the loss in value to his property. And I, from my reading, this is stymieing these smart growth advocates because they just can't pay. See, these don't stand the financial test. This is all based on people giving up rights because if they had to pay the farmer what his land is worth, they can't do it. And this is frustrating the efforts of these smart growth people. And I do see in certain states, so this is why it's very different. You know, you have to understand the demographics in a number of states. Arizona and Florida have a high percentage of snowbirds, retirees moving there, whereas other areas, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, North and South Dakota, and other places where law and order still seems to, and rule of law seems to be important, my understanding with those on the street in the petition drives have no trouble getting those eminent domain petitions signed. In fact, in their words, they literally ripped the clipboard out of their hands to sign this thing. And they may not know, understand all the nuances of the doublespeak of smart growth talk, technology slang and things like that, but they do understand the notion of having government coming in and taking their property to hand it over to Walmart or Pulte Homes.
But like we say, they're everywhere. I had some friends who just moved from here, went up, built a house in Idaho, and we're getting calls from our friends up there going, the Homeowners Association in Idaho is going crazy.
Well,
yes. Well, you're going to find that, that particular product is marketed to the recent immigrants that come from states. I hate to say it, but I think California is kind of acclimated to this, the HOA lifestyle. Why? Because I don't know if they've ever experienced much of anything else. And I don't mean that, from a derogatory standpoint, but, I always have to pause when it comes to California because I don't quite understand it.
Well, we've had on this show Lorraine Wallace from Eminent Domain as a guest on the show before, and if you want to be part of the California movement to limit eminent domain, go to limiteminentdomain, I think it's .org, on the web, and you can download a petition to get that issue on the ballot here in California. That would make a huge change in how Californians are operating. Well, Patrick, I want to thank you very much for being our guest this evening.
Thank
Time
you
goes
so much.
Fast, and I'll look forward to getting more information from you on the whole issues of HOA and what states are doing what and how that battle can be won.
Very good. Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Good night.
Good night.
You know, this is the second week in a row that I have been thrilled from one of you people out there who have called us at 888-245-4237. That Arizona call just gave me chills listening to her talk.
Well, that's great. I share that feeling. If you are not signed up to receive this Freedom 21 Santa Cruz report, go to our website and right up at the top you can do that. And
just like Ronnie from Arizona.
That's right. You can get good information and spread that into your own neighborhood. If you are receiving the report, get some friends, relatives, and neighbors so that you can begin your own take back the freedoms of America movement in your community. And so slowly but surely we will grab back the freedoms that are so rapidly these days being lost.
And don't forget to check out our website, f21santacruz.net. Got a lot of tools there for you if you want to know more and we've interested you in some of these topics. It goes far and deep, so there's a lot of things there for you to learn about.
And one last thing, we got another minute or so. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz has received a tax-exempt status. So if you want to help us out with some dollar contributions, again, go to our website and get our address, and we would really appreciate that because now our job is to spread the word.
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome back to the second hour of tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. That first hour was one important ingredient of the whole smart growth sustainable development movement. That is, how to control people right down into their home. And how do we really take away the idea of private property and run it through a group consensus that's directed from the top with a smart growth sustainable developer at the head of homeowner associations. And I'll tell you, the little bit of experience I've had with smart growth or with homeowner associations, it really is the case that they can just flip one day. You know, all of a sudden they're taken over, professional organizations come in, and holy smokes, it's just not the same again.
It's a scary thing.
Well, this hour we're going to have regular guest William Roberts back with us, and we're going to talk about regionalism, another important tool for the sustainable developers. What is regionalism, and how does it fit into American ideals? And I know our guest William Roberts is going to tell us is that regionalism is intended to reshape American ideals. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest here this hour from Missouri, Mr. William Roberts.
Good evening, Will.
Good evening, Roy, and good evening, Michael, and thanks for inviting me back to join your audience for another exciting broadcast on the Freedom 21 Network.
Well, you said it.
Well, this broadcast tonight ought to be something to take a copy of and make notes on, because the concept of regionalism is very broad and very deep. It has deep roots. It goes back a long ways, and as the listeners know, I like to go back into France right around the time of the French Revolution. Of course, that's the American Revolution period at the same time, and pick up some of these philosophers and thinkers and bring them forward as we understand their philosophy and how it impacts today.
And for those of you who are relatively new to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio production, Will was, I think you were definitely the prime mover in a series we did on Auguste Comte, early 19th century French philosopher, and the man responsible for the philosophy called positivism. And you can trace that right through to today. It's not talked about very often. It's not taught in colleges, but the concept of positivism developed by Auguste Comte is really the backbone of the Fabian movement and of sustainable development, American style. And regionalism is a big part of that whole dynamic. So I'm looking forward to information that we're
going to see. Oh yeah, this is like going to what school is supposed to be.
Well, fair enough, Roy. Well, tell us what regionalism is all about.
Well, to start off, let's just look at some of the things that we can go into tonight. And in an hour-long broadcast, of course, we're going to have to gloss in some places where we'd prefer to go into greater depth. But I was on the Internet the other day, and while I was there, I went to the Tavistock Institute. I was trying to find some specific information, and when I was there, I found some information that was quite unexpected. So tonight, we'll look at the Tavistock Institute and a companion institute, also UK, the Smith Institute, and find that localism is a term that is now back in usage, and you'll see in a few minutes why it has been out of circulation for a long time, but here it comes again.
We'll come right back to that, Will. We'll be right back once we break. Well, we're back while some audiences are away for a commercial break, and we're going to continue with our special guest, William Roberts.
We'll also take a look at and discuss localism and regionalism as found in the encyclopedias and dictionaries. We'll find that regionalism is federalism, or certainly a form of it. We'll discover that regionalism may advocate either centralization or decentralization. We'll try and get a good understanding that regionalism, neither regionalism nor localism, are at all modern buzzwords, and understand that regionalism is the ongoing process of blurring municipal, county, state, and national boundaries. And we'll also see that, like any tool, regionalism has both useful and destructive applications.
Well, what strikes me is that sixth point that you make, that understanding regionalism as an ongoing process of blurring municipal, county, state, and national boundaries. That is sustainable development. I mean, that's the goal of sustainable development. Perhaps it's happened chance that regionalism, which you're going to explain to us how deeply dated the concept of regionalism is, but that's precisely what's going on today. Starting from the federal process, working through the state process, and then right down to the local arrangements. I mean, here in Santa Cruz, county boundaries don't matter much when it comes to the dynamics of the Pajaro Valley and how it is that regionalism has taken total land use controls on a three-county basis, all using the river as the excuse for them to do that. So that we're outside of any elected official dynamic. We're now into regional governance as all land use issues are beginning to be resolved in all lands that drain into the Pajaro River Basin. But proceed, please.
Certainly. Well, you're exactly right, Michael, and it's really quite a clever strategy. It's a good strategy. When you take a look at something as large as a state, like the state of Missouri, we have 114 counties. Even when I was sitting down and putting together a pamphlet on, I called it the Local Precinct Chairman's Guide for Local Precinct Groups. It's an activation guide. But in that particular document, looking at it from the standpoint of the entire state, 114 counties, the first thing I did was cut the state in half, and then we had the west half and the east half. And then we cut it into north and south. So we had a northwest quarter, southwest quarter, southeast quarter, northeast quarter, and then went through the process of assigning regions and districts.
Hold that thought for just a second here, please. We're back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, William Roberts. We're talking about regionalism and how it came about and what it all means. So carry on, please.
And so we can see that regionalism gives you an opportunity when you look at an area and you can split it up in various ways, that you can actually create other layers of governance that are outside of the traditional boundaries. And that is primarily what I believe we will find if we go into these documents that I found on the Tavistock Institute, now on their website. Now, the Smith Institute is a corollary of partnering with the Tavistock, and on the Tavistock website, they plug, this is a plug, basically, a book and a seminar that was put out by the Smart Institute, and I'll just read the plug. It says a couple of quotes here. The seminar, which took place on Tuesday, February, and I believe that would be in 2005, February the 22nd of 2005, was entitled Smart Localism, and was held by the Smith Institute, an independent research and education think tank, which publishes pamphlets and papers on the concept of localism. So you can see that right off the bat, these people are full in swing with this. They like localism, and this idea of smart localism really caught my eye because, you know, we have smart growth. So as well, another quote, as well as debate on how to best strengthen local government in the development and delivery of public services, the event marked the publication of a new Smith Institute book, also called Smart Localism. The book features case studies of how local involvement have been put into practice. Another quote, although the concept of localism has risen up the policy agenda, and it certainly has, with all political parties arguing the case for greater local involvement in key policy issues such as the public reform, public service reform, a number of important questions remain about the key elements, processes, and potential benefits of localism. What does localism mean in practice? Now, that's the end of the quote. But we can see here that with the idea of smart localism, we're already introducing best practices, smart growth, and also, if we look at the last, the 5-6 years that Bush has been in office, and even through the Clinton administration and Bush Sr., we see that the public confidence in government is going down and down and down. And always we hear, well, lessons learned, lessons learned. But I believe that what we're seeing is an intentional discrediting of our system of government, so softening up the public to be able to accept a new system, a smart local system. Now, the Tavistock Institute, on the same website and in the same vicinity, has several quotes that I'll give here also. Disseminating lessons for practitioners and policy makers from our consultancy and research work is a priority for the Tavistock Institute. So I'm going to repeat that. Disseminating lessons for practitioners and policymakers from our consultancy and research work is a priority for the Tavistock Institute. Our work in local government covers a spectrum of topics particular interest to people involved in local partnerships, public service delivery and reform, performance improvement, and local governance.
Well, it sounds to me, Will, as though this is the formula for the... We see these bumper stickers all over Santa Cruz, global to local. It's local governance in accordance with global standards deal with delivering public services, meaning all your services under this dynamic, and everything must be in partnership with government or it can't be done. We see the elements of this rooted throughout this county, this state, and I'm going to say increasingly across the country. No one's that far. People used to laugh at Santa Cruz. Today, everybody's following Santa Cruz. It's a strange dynamic, but exactly what you're quoting from these two institutes is how it's working here in Santa Cruz. It's how our politicians are reacting, and I think you're right. The whole global to local dynamic is get rid of your national government, follow these globalist rules, do it on a local level, eliminate private property, and become sustainable.
That's exactly right. I do believe so, Michael. And so we come to the question then, seeing that it's been referred to so in such a laudatory manner here by both the Smith Institute and the Tavistock Institute, we have to ask ourselves, at least I did, what is localism? And so as the listeners to other broadcasts that we've done and that I've done on other broadcasts, they know that I look things up in the dictionary. I don't go and just run by something and not look it up. If there's a word that's not familiar whatsoever, I take the time, and we're going to do that tonight.
As a good professor should.
Well, if you look up localism in a modern dictionary and encyclopedia, there will likely be no definitive entry for localism. I'll give you the standard one, the pat one, but by no means is it definitive. It doesn't give us any clue, really, what's going on. And then certainly, there was no definitive reference for it in my collection of both dictionaries and encyclopedias, and I have a large collection of both. So that caught my eye. When something has been hidden or occulted or obfuscated, obviously from the places that we've gone together on air, you know that that's a trigger for me. So that is, however, until I turn to this new encyclopedia that was donated to my library, and I'm thankful for it. It's the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences.
Ooh.
And it was published by the Macmillan Company, copyrighted in 1933, reprinted in April of 1935, where in Volume 9, on page 585, the entry reads, this is a standalone, localism, see regionalism. Well, at that point, my eyes perked right up, my ears went, straight up like a puppy, and I was ready to start looking into something because here we're showing a synonym that is being introduced into public circulation that is obfuscating or occulting regionalism, and so we need to take a look at that. So we have previously studied the craft of the logical positivist syntactician, and with localism, Smith and Tavistock apparently are resurrecting an older term, dusting it off, giving it a fresh paint job, and reintroducing it as if it were new. By combining smart with localism, it yields smart localism. But we know that smart is synonymous with intelligent, and artificial intelligence is synonymous with electronic programming or information technology, IT. And if we compare with smart card, then we can see that perhaps smart localism is partnering with smart growth, both being planks or directions of Agenda 21, a program for action. So, given the long and infamous and well-known history of the Tavistock Institute, there is little cause for surprise. We'll pass on the Tavistock and the Smith Institute, that we could spend days on that. But for now, we'll just go right into our study and continue here. Let's look at localism. I call it a ghost from the past. Experience has proven that whenever a new topic comes under consideration, the best place to begin is the dictionary, as I said earlier. And we know that words have meanings, and their meanings are important. The first time I heard that phrase was from William Cooper on The Hour of the Time. Mm-hmm. We know from our study of the logical positivists, that's Rudolf Carnap and the others, Alfred Ayer, to say a thing is not strictly to mean a thing, and what is meant is not necessarily what is thought. So I'll repeat that again for those that didn't catch that broadcast. But to say a thing is not strictly to mean a thing, and what is meant is not necessarily what is thought. So there's many layers or levels of this obfuscatory linguistics that are happening on us and at us, and Tavistock is a champion in mind control and programming. So to study these words, then, we look at the origin and the development of each term from both an etymological and a philological perspective, and doing so, it reveals much. So let's look at this word local, its roots and its meaning, and I'll only give a couple of definitions, not to bore the audience. But localism, as can be found in a common dictionary, is an idiom, a mannerism, a custom, or the like, particular to a locality. So it's an idiom, mannerism, custom, or the like, particular to a locality.
Well, that's certainly not the meaning given in the discussion you've had heretofore.
No, sir. It certainly isn't, but it suffices for general inquiry. The second sense in this definition from a common dictionary, which I'll cite in a moment, is provincialism. Now, we'll see how this word provincialism plays into regionalism as we get into this study further. But we can notice here now that localism is synonymous with provincialism, as provincialism is synonymous with regionalism. So to mean a thing, and what is meant is not necessarily what is thought, develops this thought that we have a train of words that all really relate to the same issues, but they're just different layers of the game. Now let's look at local, which is what localism is.
But hang on a second. Different layers to the game. You mean the game of confusion, of misleading people, of getting people on board a program they don't understand and wouldn't believe in if they understood it.
Well, when we realize that when it goes from global to local, Michael, as you're very well aware, but the audience may not, is that when you start to appoint these boards and Soviet councils, as we like to call them, typically, the people are cannon fodder. They are very well-meaning in their volunteer spirit, but they're generally selected not for their knowledge or for their merit, but simply for their volunteer spirit. And if you can fill a panel up with people who are not quite up to speed, then it's fairly simple to facilitate them into accepting a consensus on a predetermined outcome. And so this concept then of localism being synonymous with regionalism, being synonymous with provincialism, is just another layer of this programming of local minds to perform global agendas. Did I answer your question?
That sure does. Thank you.
Okay. So local then, the next word, is of or relating to a place. In the second sense, it's pertaining to, existing in, of interest to, peculiar to, or serving a locality, local government. So we can see right here in localism, this is a good use of a term. It does have to do with local government, or governance, as they say. also remembering what we learned from Auguste Comte and his relationship with the François Bichat, Marie-François Bichat. He was a physiologist, and so many of the much of the writing of Auguste Comte related the human being to, and the social group to, a body organism, an organism, and we find organism throughout the writings of following positivists and pragmatists like John Dewey and others. So here, local also has a medical relationship. It's ever affecting a limited part of the body. It's not systemic. It's a local disease. And so when we're thinking about localism, we can just tuck it in our cap and realize that we're dealing with a local disease here, and I think we need to fight the disease and eradicate it.
That's good.
Now, the next step would be to continue the word out and go locate. Now, to locate is to determine or specify the position and boundaries of, or let's say, Albany, New York, or something like that. So here we have a specification. Local is actually someplace pretty tightly defined. It's not as loose. We'll see why that's important in just a moment. And it's also, under location, it's the fact of being located or settled. And there certainly can't be anything more poignant when we think about smart growth and sustainable development and these urban communities where we go inside of boundaries will be resettled, the resettlement, the rewilding of America. So all of these words really do have significance, and localism becomes a pretty descriptive term if you take it in a broader aspect. And remember, as I've mentioned before, the listeners and others, whenever we see an ism, we're very likely dealing with a belief system. Belief systems have a founder, typically. They also have a faith statement, if you will. And in a few minutes, we will reveal who the founder of the original idea of regionalism is. But we'll have to do continued digging to find out who the first person to come up with localism was. Now, those definitions were from the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. And I can see the time is going pretty quickly, so I'm going to speed up. I'll pass over the choice ones that I had from Noah Webster's 1828. Let's look now at regionalism. We'll go right into it and start again with the dictionary. And region, I guess I should say this first. When we look at the dictionary, you will not find the term regionalism. You'll find other terms, and we'll use those. But in none of the dictionaries that I have, all the way up to 2006, none of them have regionalism, curiously enough. So region, then, is the root of regionalism, is any large, usually continuous segment of a surface or space. It's an area. It's a large and indefinite portion of the Earth's surface. It's a specific district or a territory. But region has a root, regere, and in that term, it is to guide, to rule, the realm, the regent, the regime, the regent, the regiment, the tribal king, a bishopric, reich, rich, ruler, regal, rex, royal, etc. So there's a little bit more hanging out there in region than meets the eye. We need to study our words. They have meanings, and the meanings are important. Then we'll jump into regional, of, pertaining to, or characteristic of a large geographic region. So it's defining itself through the use of the region, which is not proper, but it's done so anyway. Of, pertaining to, or characteristic of a particular region or district localized. So there is a tie to local in the word region. But typically speaking, a region is much more vast than that. It's a tract of land of or space of indefinite extent, usually a tract of considerable extent. It is sometimes nearly synonymous with country, and that's from Noah Webster's 1828. So we can see that on one hand we have localism, and on the other hand we have regionalism.
Well, it strikes me that the concept of regionalism, what really strikes me there is this notion that it is indefinite. And regionalism, I mean, you can go back to Ronald Reagan, who said that the local political system is a horse and buggy system and that we needed regionalism. But if you don't have defined boundaries of your region, you can't have an open political process. You then have to resort to a Soviet process where the insiders become the power crats who implement the rules that come from above. And that's why I suspect regionalism is so important to the sustainable developers, because they don't want to have boundaries. They don't want to have definitions to anything. They want to have watersheds. What's a watershed? Well, gee whiz, a watershed can run in a lot of different directions, and it cuts over boundaries, and it does political boundaries, etc. And that's why there's such a move in this country to establish regional authorities for water or for transportation or for all kinds of things. And here in the state of California, it was Ronald Reagan, of all people, who really brought that to the fore. And, of course, since then, it has just taken off here and everywhere.
Well, if the politicians weren't working from scripts, as I'm reading tonight, I would be surprised with that. But understanding that that's the direction that we've been going for a long time in America, it's no surprise that he started, you know, bringing the words out and putting them up for public consumption. The term region, now this is from the World Book Encyclopedia, is an area with common characteristics that sets it off from other areas. It may be part of a city, a county, state, province, nation, or of the world. People do not agree, and this is important, on how to identify regions, draw their boundaries, or appraise their significance. Where the West, the East, the South, or the North begins depends upon where a person is standing. So a region general then has no distinct geographical or political boundary. Its identity is usually one of character. For example, a region may have natural characteristics. It may be known for its mountains, rivers, climate, soil, minerals, crops, or forests. An economic region may include all or part of a natural region. Cultural, historical, and political regions are also decided along their particular lines, or according to their interests and purposes. Each region has conflicting as well as unifying interests. And we can go on with that one, but this dictionary, or this encyclopedia, the World Book, it provides a real tight, nice, concise summary. It's only a couple of paragraphs long. But in the earlier encyclopedia that I cited, and I'm not going to continue to repeat it, but it's the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences, published by the Macmillan Company, copyrighted again in 1933, we finally tap into scholarly research worthy of study. And I say that because of the nature and the authors of this Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences. This is a book that was written for the development and the enculturation, I guess you could say, of the super social scientists that were being educated in the 1930s, and yeah, they are the people who are now in power today.
Let me stop for a second, because the whole concept of social sciences has been dealt with on this show in an edition by Erica Carl. And if you don't understand the dynamic of social sciences and how it has changed the nature of the American experience, go to our archives at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz and to the radio page and find the show on social sciences by Erica Carl, because that'll give you a lot of background for what it is that Will's about to talk about.
That's right, Michael. And she was adamantly opposed to, if not alerting people, to get their children away from sociology. And anyone that takes the time to go to the library and get a modern book on sociology, or check out a textbook at a university library, you'll see why. Most of the problems that we have today are being brought in, inculcated all the way through the educational system, as Charlotte Iserby has so well put together. And we are the product of how we've been educated. And on another broadcast, we can talk further about the educational process. But the social sciences are absolutely fundamental to positivism, the way that the worldview of Henri Saint-Simon and Auguste Comte, and the super social scientists will support the appointed dictator. But the world will be run by the captains of finance and industry in that worldview. So this is why, when I got this opportunity to obtain this encyclopedia set, I launched onto it. It's huge. The writing is excellent. And the authors are of great note here, because most of them are very well-known socialists, communists, and progressives. So with that said, I can see that we're coming to the bottom of the hour, but we're going to start in on this regional planning article. I've edited down quite a bit out of two very lengthy articles, and compressed some of the very core of what regional planning is, and what regionalism is, according to the super social scientists.
We'll be right back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show in just a bit. We're back while some stations take their commercial break with our special guest, Will Roberts. And let's just keep talking this subject, because we're going to wish in half an hour that we had another hour to go.
Well, no doubt, another hour or another 3 hours, but we have plenty of time to go through some of what I want to present this evening, and we can look into it deeper at another time. But regional planning, this is the article out of the encyclopedia now. Regional planning, if the need for regional planning is evident in the growth of the modern metropolis beyond its officially designated city limits.
Now, who's saying that?
This was written by one of the authors of this text, and I'm not sure whether I kept that in when I was editing for the radio or not. I'll look and see if I did. I don't think I did.
But this is in the Macmillan Company encyclopedia.
Yes, this is in the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences.
Right. I can't wait till he unveils those names.
But yes, go on.
There are plenty. Now, during the decade, before I continue, I'm just going to come right back, because this is so fundamentally important to the entire discussion. The need for regional planning is evident in the growth of the modern metropolis beyond its officially designated city limits. Now, in previous broadcasts, I've done studies on the word metro and metropolitan, but we know that metro, 1313, is very important, and for the people in the audience that are understanding of that, I would tune your ears in, because we're going into that study a little bit further tonight. Now, during the decade, the article continues, from 1920 to 1930, the increase in population of the 85 largest cities of the United States was 5,622,986, a rise of 19.4%. But the growth in the population of the areas in the metropolitan region surrounding these cities was 4,362,936, amounting to a 39.2% increase. Now, the chief causes of this spread of population in suburban areas beyond the city limits are to be found in the rapid development of modern science and transportation, especially the motor vehicle. Now, remember, when we were riding here, we're riding back in the 20s and 30s, so the motor vehicle is definitely just coming on here. The increasing tendency toward industrial decentralization and the growth of residential suburbs. Now, any one of those three we could spend an hour on, and their importance is tremendous. But the extension of the city limits has not kept pace with the spread of population. Grave problems of municipal administration have resulted, bringing with them new and difficult changes in city finance and taxation. And as you've heard 1,000 times, follow the money. So in an effort to meet these problems, the movement for regional city planning, or regional planning, has grown up, sponsored both officially and unofficially by municipal and industrial engineers, architects, housing experts, economists, and rural and town planners.
Hold the next thought. We're going to welcome our audience right back. Welcome back, for those who've been away, to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. In the last few minutes, our special guest, William Roberts, has explained how regional planning, as designed in the 1920s, acknowledged that the vehicle and industrial decentralization has resulted in the growth of residential suburbs. And for the progressives of the era, that created a real problem. They couched that problem in terms of city finance and taxation. And from there, let's continue with the discussion.
Well, before we do that, we have a caller on the line, Roger from Pennsylvania. Roger, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, gents. Besides going against the fundamental tenet that one of the elements of good government is that any governmental function deemed necessary be reposed at the lowest government level possible, and beyond that, the seductive allure of the regionalists, of course, has it that the economies of scale is the sales pitch. Now, that sounds entirely plausible, but of course you find out that what might have otherwise been the first several years' savings is eaten up in the transition costs, of course. And then after that, you find out that each governmental unit is clamoring for a bigger, you know, or smaller subdivision, let's say, is clamoring for their share of the pie. So, of course, there is no incentive to reduce the overall governmental spending like you would have in, and then of course you repose the accountability, the responsibility to far more distant and unaccountable units. And God bless you all.
Well, what do you say to that?
Well, I think he's exactly on point. And if we have time to get through to the last 15-minute segment or thereabouts and actually touch on that, it'll be in the text of these of tonight's discussion. But he's very right in that there's a false savings that happens in this process. And again, it's just a matter of propaganda, basically, that by going into alternate forms of government and deviating from our constitutional representative form of government, that we're going to have miracles and cures to everything that ails us. But the reality is that's not the case. But the subversion is the goal, the subversion of the constitutional process, and national sovereignty, state sovereignty, the boundaries, and all of that's the goal, really, that lies behind regionalism, and we will see that as we continue. So, in most cases, the regional plan does not correspond in an area with any single administrative unit. That's important. In most cases, a regional plan does not correspond in an area with any single administrative unit. There is no governmental organization ready to approve and execute that plan, which, moreover, usually has no legal sanction. So we start off with our great plan, our visioning sessions, and our councils, but there's no police power. And so other systems have to come into play. Now, although cities and their suburbs have remained politically separate, the city and its surrounding areas are becoming more and more interdependent. Now, this was being written back in the 20s and 30s, and here we're going to just hear every word that we've heard lately, but here's interdependence thrown in. This interdependence is evident in the public utilities, in provision for education, in recreation facilities, in land uses, in the transaction of private business, and in the social and economic life of the region as a whole.
Well, I don't think that folks 20 years ago identified American systems of governance as being interdependent. In fact, things were considered independent, and yet this term, which I hear from local school officials all the time, that the world's become an interdependent world, is an idea that goes back 70, 80 years, according to this research that you're providing us tonight. So it took them a long time to incubate the concept of our mutual interdependence and the lacking of a national or individual independence.
Exactly right, Michael. And this article is just absolutely loaded with terms that we can pull right out and lay on the table, and these are the things that are bothering us today. And as I said before, this writing was done as an instruction method. Not only was it a way for the super social scientists to talk to one another through their encyclopedia, but this was also probably on the shelves of all of the professors. This was in the hands of access in the libraries for many of the students. And so reading these documents and going through this process, this is what they understand, this is what they were teaching, and that's why I'm bringing it out, is so that we can dust off this old vaulted encyclopedia set and bring it back into the light and realize that the program for action, the Agenda 21, is a fulfillment of dreams that go back into the 1800s. So in Illinois, the State Chamber of Commerce, and I've made that bold and underlined it in my book, the State Chamber of Commerce has made studies to determine the advisability of forming a unified, systematic plan for the development of the state's resources. In Iowa, the State Board of Conservation and the State Fish and Game Commission have issued a report on a 25-year conservation plan. In New York State, studies of widespread scope were made as early as 1925 by the Bureau of Housing and Regional Planning. Now, it's not called that anymore, but it was in effect in 1925. Impetus is being given to the movement for non-urban planning. This is the earliest citation. This is the first and the earliest that I've seen for those words combined together, urban planning. I've never seen it any earlier than this. Okay, the movement for non-urban planning, the CONTRA, by the activities of the National Land Use Planning Committee, it probably didn't know it existed at that time, composed of representatives of various federal departments and the land grant colleges, the purpose of which is to determine a plan for the suitable use, primarily, of rural land areas. So these land grant colleges is a focus of a study that I've been looking at lately. Through the Extension Office, they have the ability to promulgate into the rural areas and perhaps even into metropolitan areas a considerable amount of information that has been cooked up over the years that actually enables facilitators to facilitate these meetings when we are building Soviet councils and Soviet groups of people who perhaps don't have as high a degree of education, or perhaps they're retirees now who are living in the hinterlands and coming together to form planning commissions that may not understand planning whatsoever, but through the agency of the university college extension, the land grant colleges, they have the dissemination of these Tavistock type documents and Smith Institute documents right into their hands. So it goes from global to local through the land grant colleges.
And here in California, the land grant college, of course, is the University of California, with its branches in Davis and Santa Cruz, probably leading the pack for this kind of extension service that reinvents the American system of government.
Well, this whole idea of regional planning is vast, and we can spend hours on it, but I do want to get to the regionalism as a study, and so I'm going there next. But we can understand that international planning is an attempt of coordinating national planning, and national planning is an attempt to coordinate regional planning, just as regional planning coordinates city planning. And so it follows along broad lines. We take into consideration the requirements of the entire country as a whole, including open spaces, distribution of population, location of industries, public utilities, provision for various forms of circulation. And national planning sometimes extends into international planning, as I said. Rivers and valleys are units for planning and not natural frontiers. The natural frontiers are the sea, the desert, and the mountains. And from my study of Hugo Grote's writing in Pufendorf and the Natural Law, in the early days, long before this document was written, we understood certain boundaries of what you could legislate and what you couldn't. The sea was always free because you could not possess it. Things that can be possessed can be owned. But under the idea of regional planning and regionalism, we can etch-a-sketch away and take away this concept of possession. And for a topic on another night, we can understand that we really have been deprived of legal title on our lands. And that's part of the reason why it's so easy to do civil asset forfeitures and seizures and to replicate wherever desirable the Kelo case. So,
and I think it really ties into our last hour with regard to homeowner associations and the thrust of the kinds of restrictions that can impose on homeowners.
Exactly right. So let's look then quickly, because we're running out of time. We'll look at regionalism, and this again is from the same encyclopedia. The term regionalism is of comparatively recent origin and has not accepted any, and has not yet acquired any accepted precise definition. I'll say it again. In the 1925 and the 1930s, when this was being written, published, and reprinted, regionalism, the term regionalism, is of comparatively recent origin and has not yet been acquired any accepted precise definition. Now, here's the founder. Here's the founder of the ism. It was first used, or we can say coined into existence, it was first used in 1874 in the works of the provincial, there's our word provincial right out of the definition of localism, provincial poet, and I won't attempt his name, it's like Berlet Perusus, Frenchman, but did not come into wide currency until the 1890s. Regionalism has been called a manifestation of world federalism, and it is an intermediate stage between administrative decentralization and federalism. It involves such diverse problems of modern political and cultural life as those of minorities, think illegal aliens, administrative decentralization, local self-government, and autonomy, the cult of homeland, homeland security, and Earth, good old Gaia, and local patriotism. It is most intimately related to particularism, which is another ism and has its own founder and faith statement, and opponents make the charge that it leads to separatism. In a very general way, regionalism may be defined as a counter-movement to any exaggerated or oppressive form of centralization. Now, you know, we have a centralized system of government. This is, in fact, a federal government. We have a federal government. It's centralized. And so the concept of regionalism, as we see here, it is a counter-movement to any exaggerated or oppressive form of centralization. And all across Europe, this regionalism, when it was fanned into flames here in the 1870s, it was going after, initially, the monarchs. And the whole French Revolution centers around regionalism. That you didn't know that. But that was largely the issue. And so when we look at that from that standpoint, you can say, well, hey, liberty, equality, fraternity, who can be against the French Revolution? They were throwing off the nasty king. Well, if you just happen to be a king, then in the time that Auguste Comte was writing, he absolutely opposed what he considered the opposition. The opposition was, in his days, those that would throw off the original system of government. He wasn't as far out there in the left lane as possible. He was more of a conservative in his day. But conservative to Auguste Comte is contra our system of government here. So we do need to pay really close attention. Not everything is obvious, and sometimes it takes a lot of study to really get to the kernel, the meat of the nut. Regionalist problems arise only where there is a combination of two or more such factors as geographic isolation, independent historical traditions, racial, ethnic, or religious peculiarities, and local economic or class interests. Regionalism must be distinguished from nationalism in that it recognizes a higher national unity and superior national interests, transcending the attachment to the local region. So regionalism is aiming at or driving at a change in government. And as my study in socialism and that process, even communism, goes, it always is dependent upon tension. There must be tension. You got to push, push, push. Well, you can go to the Hegelian dialectic. You've got one thing here and an opposite over there, and it squeezes out exactly what you wanted all along. So opposition is necessary. Tension is important. And whether you make the tension with the media, whether you make the tension up through the schools, whether you use anarchists or agitators, tension is required to make the change happen.
Or you simply elect local politicians who are trained as, this is their term, change agents.
Change agents. And they may not know it, but that's the education and that's the training that they've gotten. And so they're given their cookies at the right time, and perhaps they're given a bonus check from time to time. But that's exactly right. We come in, and to destabilize a community, we can come in with something like regionalism. So transcending the attachment to the local region, then, it must be distinguished also from mere sectionalism in that it is not based exclusively on regional economic or class interests, but it involves certain ethnic factors, such as cultural, traditional, or linguistic peculiarities, which provide a basis for what is sometimes termed subnationality. So as we have this flood of illegal immigrants coming in, we're setting up this opportunity where, for regionalism, we'll have to set up a place for them to have their culture and practice their language and their traditions so as that they can feel like they are they have their own identity, but they're an identity inside of this nation. And that's what happened all over France. And that's what happened in Spain. And that's what happened in Italy. And the Balkanization of all of those nations, they were countries or regions at the time, but that is how you got the present departments in France today. They threw away the old boundaries, redrew the boundaries, and came out anew. Now, what would happen in the United States if we threw away all of our state boundaries? Well, first of all, if you throw away all of the state boundaries, you have to throw away all of the state constitutions, because the state constitutions that I've read, particularly for Missouri, they start out by defining the territory. And so if you throw away the territory, you no longer have a valid contract. You've changed the whole program. So regionalism is a very useful tool if the goal is change, and change agents affect that change. Now, I'm not going to go through, we have 10 minutes to go here, I'm not going to go through all that it was, but for those that want to study the French Revolution with a new eye, you can do that, and then look into how all of these various struggles for identity, language, local customs and traditions affected the way that the modern state of France was developed. And I can see throughout Europe and England, the United Kingdom wasn't out of it completely. In the United Kingdom, they had to face their own problems, which had been considered as aspects of federalism. The Scottish autonomy movement and the Irish question came up. On the other hand, some of its central problems have been compared to the French regionalism. So there's a comparison here, and this is again back to that article in the encyclopedia. Here, the prime desideratum was to lift the burden of government from the central parliament. This problem had already occupied public attention at the time of Gladstone, who, at inaugurating the so-called committee system, had transferred certain powers from the plenum to committees. And so we didn't always have committees in our system of in the legislature. The legislature met as a body, and they discussed things, and they went through them. But the same was the case in England, and the same was the case in France. You know, parliament, and our legislature, three different forms, there are three different names for the very similar system. But when you introduce everything into committees, and as we've talked about on this broadcast, if you have the legislative drafting group working with the American Bar Association, who are working with the Russell Sage Foundation, and they're working with the America's Bankers Union, then we have the door wide open to The Hague. We can bring in international ideas, global agendas, and bring them all the way down through our system of government into the committees. The committee chairs can select those items that they'll bring up for this year's discussion and what will come to a vote against those that will not. And then only those approved pieces of legislation ever make it to the floor. And of course, with regionalism, it's the buddy system. With regionalism, you want to get chips for your area, and so you throw in with another region and give them something that they want, and it starts to be give and take, trade and trade alike. And that really subverts our entire system of government. Now, this encyclopedia has in it a paragraph that I find not quite true. And so just because we go to the best sources that we can, we don't always stop with one saying or one place. But this is a paragraph that caught our attention. It says, in the United States, regionalism has never really appeared. Now, of course, this was
being written 70 years ago, though.
This was being written in 1925 through 1930. Such sectional manifestations as have occurred in the history of the country from time to time, the threat of New England to break away from the Union in 1814, the secession of the Southern states in the Civil War, the alignment of the agrarian West and South against the industrial East in 1896, were the results of economic antagonisms rather than consciously held regional philosophies. Certainly, as far as tradition, culture, and language are concerned, if the small occasional and temporary islands of immigrant settlements are accepted, the United States has always presented the aspect of a unified nationalist grouping. Efforts have been made, however, to foresee the future development of the United States along regionalist lines, notably by the historian Frederick J. Turner, whose theory of sectionalism, we hear about sectors all the time, is in effect a regional approach. Thus, in 1925, Turner wrote, "The significant fact is that the sectionalized self-consciousness and sensitiveness is likely to be increased as time goes on, as crystallized sections feel the full influence of their geographic peculiarities and their special interests and their developed ideas in a closed and static nation. Now, we know that there's never anything static that's alive. Everything that is alive is dynamic. But here in this comment that this Mr. Turner, Frederick J. Turner, wrote in 1925, he basically says that we have crystallized sections. And I don't believe that's at all true. And he says that our sensitiveness is likely to be increased as time goes on, as the crystallized sections feel the full influence of their geographic peculiarities, their special interests, and their developed ideals in a closed and static nation. We have diversity in our nation almost by default. We have the seaboards on either side, and we have the lake shores of the Great Lakes. And in all of those places, they were just given, not only in the age and time of settlement, but also given, due to their access to the ocean, absolute heads up and head start for industrial development. But out in the hinterland, up until the railroads and up until the semi-trucks and whatnot, we were agrarian. This area out here shall be, a farming area largely. And from here to there, over and over, you might find a little bit of an industrial area. But even today, that is generally assembly.
This 1925 encyclopedia or treatise discounts regionalism in America. Today, where I'm sitting, we have regional water authorities, which are doing a failed job, but have absolute power over water, which means they control farming and they're controlling so much more. We have regional transportation commissions, which control our roads and impose very expensive alternative transportation systems. We have regional government called LAFCO, the Local Area Formation Committee, and regional government tells the elected representatives what they can and can't do on all the policies that we might think important or relevant. So what I observe from this last hour is that regionalism is here. It wasn't a theory discussed in 1925. It has been one that the process has continued to work toward the death, toward the ruin of the American system, as regionalism is firmly in place today in California and across the country.
I would agree with you, and I think that localism is a Siamese twin with regionalism. And so when we hear more about localism, when you start to see it come up in dialogue and discourse, we'll be donning on the spot and a little ahead of time, hopefully, and we'll be able to understand that when someone's talking about localism in a planning board or a committee, he's really talking about regionalism.
Well,
and, go ahead.
I'm just going to say we're about out of time. I want to thank you very much. Once again,
I wish my teachers in school were this interesting.
Yeah, that's right. And so if you're a teacher, you can start assigning some of the Freedom 21 radio shows, which are logged in on the internet at freedom21santacruz.net. And if you are a teacher, check them out. Have your students begin to understand what some of the real issues in today's political world really are. Thank you very much again.